This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms from coast to coast. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. On this Independence Day weekend, we're taking a look back at the tragic July 4th mass shooting that claimed 7 lives and injured nearly 50 others at a suburban Chicago parade in 2022. A young boy who was injured in that mass shooting remains partially paralyzed. We'll also be thinking about how that mass shooting and the numerous violent events in the U.S. that have made headlines over the past decades have changed the way that we celebrate. As our nation marks our 250th anniversary, are we finding it harder to trust each other, to relax, and to have a good time with our neighbors? Before we dive into Odyssey's coverage of the Highland Park July 4th shooting, we have some quick crime updates from around the country. We'll actually start in the Chicago area with a report from Odyssey station WBBM News Radio from Friday, July 3rd.
A judge this week sentenced Drew Jarvis to 45 years for first-degree murder, 31 years for attempted first-degree murder, and 20 years for armed violence. Prosecutors say in 2020 in Elgin, a car Jarvis was riding in cut off another vehicle. When the driver honked at the car, Jarvis shot at the vehicle, wounding the driver and killing the passenger. Just a week later, Jarvis shot someone else. His arrest in the second shooting helped investigators connect him to the road rage murder. Roger Plummer, News Radio, 105.9 WBBM.
In Philadelphia on Friday, Odyssey station KYW News Radio reported on a shooting investigation that's underway.
Someone gunned down a woman in North Philly late last night, and police are trying to figure out if she was targeted. Police found the woman bleeding on the sidewalk at 25th and Master Street. She later died at the hospital. There were at least 20 spent shell casings on the street corner. Chief Inspector Scott Small.
Now, fortunately, there are police real-time crime cameras that did record two light-colored vehicles, both sedans, fleeing from this location.
He says they're also checking Philadelphia Housing Authority cameras and private business cameras for additional angles.
Earlier in the week, KYW reported on two arrests of teens linked to the murder of a college student in June. Here's the first report from Wednesday, July 1st.
Well, U.S. Marshals have arrested one of the two suspects accused of killing a Penn State student in South Philly last month. Police officials confirm that 16-year-old Azubar Uten Fleming of Philadelphia was arrested by marshals in Colorado this evening. Marshals say they determined he had distant family members out there. He's currently awaiting extradition back to Philadelphia, where he will face murder, robbery, and other related offenses. Authorities are still searching for 16-year-old Kasim Smith. Authorities still offering a $5,000 reward for his capture. Rob Clark with the U.S. Marshal's Office, he says during the search, some relatives were taken into custody.
Two individuals were arrested during the course of this investigation. One was arrested for hindering apprehension. Another person just had an outstanding warrant that we ran into.
And one of those two has been charged with obstruction of justice and tampering with evidence for allegedly taking a suspect out of Philadelphia. DA Larry Krasner.
Dante Abdul Malik is 35 years old. He is the stepfather of Azubair Barton Fleming.
Penn State Billy Schmidt was killed in the early hours of June 6th, the near 20th and Wolf Street, when he was walking home from a bar. Officials say the teens ambushed him, took his phone, and when Schmidt chased after them, they say Smith turned and fired the fatal shot into his chest. Smith is considered armed and dangerous. Anyone with information has to call authorities.
On Thursday, KYW reported on the second arrest in the case.
The second and final suspect wanted in connection with the fatal shooting of a Penn State student in South Philadelphia is now in custody. The U.S. Marshals Service says the alleged shooter, 16-year-old Kasim Smith, surrendered to police today. Marshals say 16-year-old Azubair Outen Fleming was apprehended last night in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Officials say the teens robbed 22-year-old Billy Schmidt of his cell phone near 20th and Wolf Street on June 6th. It's alleged that Smith then fired a fatal shot into Schmidt's chest. Schmidt was a communications major at Penn State and was expected to graduate this fall.
And even earlier in the week, KYW covered a murder-suicide described by locals as heartbreaking.
A man shot and killed his uncle during an argument and then turned the gun on himself. It happened yesterday morning in Glenside, Montgomery County. Abington Township police say 28-year-old Brandon Maurer shot his 54-year-old uncle, Billy Maurer. There were other family members home at the time, but they were not hurt. Neighbors tell NBC 10 they were kind of stunned to hear what had happened inside that house.
It was pretty heartbreaking. It's pretty heartbreaking. This is very close for comfort. I walk here all the time. My kids are out here all the time. I mean, they're older, but they take walks late at night. I mean, it's really disheartening, to be honest.
Police say they found a gun owned by Brandon at the scene.
In the Twin Cities this Wednesday, Odyssey station WCCO News Talk reported on a teen girl facing murder charges. Here's why.
A teen is now charged in the fatal bludgeoning of her mother in their Maplewood apartment this past weekend. A 17-year-old Twin Cities girl is facing second-degree murder charges after allegedly beating her 43-year-old mother to death with a hammer following an argument over a cell phone. Investigators recovered surveillance footage of the suspect carrying a hammer. Prosecutors are now petitioning the court to certify the teenager to stand trial as an adult.
WCCO then reported Thursday on a man who opened fire at police.
Owatonna police say a man suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound last night after opening fire at police. WCCO's Mark Fry.
That incident got underway around 8:20 last night with an initial traffic stop where police found a person in crisis. That individual drew a firearm and opened fire at police before fleeing. The 36-year-old suspect later stopped in the 200 block of West McKinley Street in Owatonna, prompting a standoff and shelter-in-place order. That suspect later shot himself and was taken to a hospital shortly after midnight. No officers were injured.
There were also multiple shooting incidents reported in the Twin Cities area last weekend. Here's WCCO's report on the crimes from Monday, June 29th.
A number of shootings in the Twin Cities this past weekend, one of them fatal.
The fatal shooting happened yesterday at 1 a.m. on Bloomington Avenue in Minneapolis, where police found the victim lying on the ground. He was taken to a hospital where he died. Nine others were hurt in the other shootings over the weekend between Friday night and yesterday morning. The only shooting that has led to an arrest so far happened at Hennepin and Laurel on Sunday morning. Two teens were taken into custody after a 15-year-old girl was shot. Al Schock, News Talk 830 WCCO.
In St. Louis, Missouri, the Mark Cox Morning Show from 97.1 The Talk discussed a case where the accused is just 10 years old.
The 10-year-old boy who is accused of murdering his 7-month-old niece is going to be tried in juvenile court. They're saying that Missouri law would prevent him from being tried as an adult. Now, he is facing a first-degree murder charge, but in order for him to be tried as an adult, he'd have to be 12 years old. Missouri law, that's the cutoff.
Well, we now know the relationship then, at least,
we do.
Right? It was a niece?
Yep, a niece. Mother of the 7-month-old, it's her only baby, who was shot and killed. And she's asking for prayer, says that she has love and forgiveness in her heart. The 10-year-old boy was taken to the hospital for evaluation, psychiatric evaluation. And he's also being placed in the protective custody, it says, of Missouri Children's Division.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, yeah.
I'm sure. Can you imagine the trauma that child went through? I mean, not that there shouldn't be repercussions for what, I assume it's a he did.
Yep.
But, I mean, the emotional trauma, I just can't imagine what the family's going through. And the dad is the one now facing second-degree murder charges, right?
The dad of
the infant?
The baby.
Yes.
Yeah, because obviously the dad's 19, so he would not be the dad of the 10-year-old.
Correct.
So, just a really horrible story. The 10-year-old is the youngest in Missouri's history, to my knowledge, to be charged with first-degree murder.
And in Detroit, Odyssey station WWJ News Radio provided an update Thursday on threats of violence against Muslims over the weekend.
WWJ's John Hewitt is live, and he's letting us know what they are saying. John? Tracy, the threats came Sunday via voicemail against the American Islamic Community Mosque in Madison Heights from a 35-year-old man identified by Oakland County prosecutors as Christopher Lord. The members of the Imams Council of Michigan read from that transcript. This was the threat verbatim, quote, "I am going to kill you. I am going to kill your people. We're going to get rid of you one way or another. Get out of my country before it's too late." Among those speaking up and speaking out is Imam Steve Mustafa El Turk, president of the Islamic Organization of America.
"These incidents reflect a disturbing climate of religious intolerance, the continued rise in anti-Muslim threats and Islamophobic rhetoric across our nation demands a united response from law enforcement, elected officials, faith leaders, and civil society."
Lord is facing two charges, including false threat of terrorism and using a computer to commit a crime. Prosecutors describe him as homeless. Both of those charges, by the way, are 20-year felonies. Reporting live, John Hewitt, WWJ News Radio 950.
This threat came in the wake of a shooting that claimed three lives at the Islamic Center of San Diego in May. On Wednesday, Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles reported on the latest case involving the 2023 death of a protester in California.
Some people feel the man who caused the death of an elderly Jewish protester 2.5 years ago in Thousand Oaks got off with a slap on the wrist. Here's Emily Valdez.
The Ventura County DA asked the judge to sentence Loway Abdel Fattah al-Naji to 2 years in prison after he pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter for the death of Paul Kessler. The two were at opposing protests on the corner of Thousand Oaks and Westlake Boulevards. When they got into an argument, al-Naji hit Kessler with his bullhorn, causing Kessler to fall, hit his head, and die.
I believe his one-year sentence in the Ventura County Jail, he'll only have to serve about 6 months.
Do you think that's appropriate?
Not at all.
Freddie, who is Jewish, was in the courtroom for the sentencing.
Mr. Kessler weighed probably, I would say, 135 pounds, and Mr. al-Naji was 100 pounds more. To me, it was not right because it was definitely manslaughter, and he should have got 2 years in prison.
This was a tragedy.
Al-Naji's defense attorney, Ram Bamye, believes this sentence is appropriate.
The problem is there are all these people that are equating this act as something different than what it is, that somehow it's a hate crime. It can't be a hate crime under the law. Somehow it's a murder. It can't be a murder under the law. It just can't.
Al-Naji is set to begin his jail term in August. I'm Emily Valdez, KNX News.
On July 4th, 2022, Highland Park, Illinois, held its annual Independence Day parade. Families filled the downtown area of this Chicago suburb, basking in summer sun and holiday cheer. It was around 10:15 in the morning when gunshots tore through the peaceful scene. As the shooter opened fire, 7 people sustained fatal injuries. 48 others were also injured, but they survived. An 8-year-old boy who was injured in the spine survived. But even today, he remains paralyzed. Another boy, who was just 2 at the time of the shooting, lost both of his parents in the tragedy. Here's Odyssey station WBBM News Radio's reporting on the tragedy from the day after the shooting, July 5th, 2022.
Park facing a new reality this morning following the deadly shooting massacre at its 4th of July parade. WBBM's Mike Krauser joins us live now from Highland Park with an update.
Well, Cisco, we are at the police station here in Highland Park, and new this morning is from Mayor Nancy Rotering, who says the gun used in the shooting, high-powered rifle, was legally obtained. We don't know if they traced the weapon, and that is how they identified 21-year-old Robert Cremo as the suspect in this case. But the gun was left behind, and authorities could quickly check that if, in fact, that was registered in his name. The mayor also said on the Today Show His online postings reflected a plan and a desire to commit carnage for a long time in advance. Dave Berner will have more on the suspect as we go through the morning, but it remains, the numbers of the victims remain the same. Six dead, about 30 injured. Most of the injured who were wounded were treated and released at area hospitals. Now we are awaiting charges. Live in Highland Park, Mike Krauser, 105.9 WBBM.
Thank you, Mike. And hospitals went into emergency response mode to handle the influx of patients following that shooting. Brigham Temple is a doctor with the North Shore University Health System in Highland Park. He talks about the victims who were treated there.
Some of them were minor, some of them were much more severe, and some of those patients were in critical condition when they did arrive here to the hospital.
Any commonality between the gunshot injuries? Were they all different parts of the body?
They were all different parts of the body, extremities as well as other more central parts of the body as well.
WBBM's Dave Berner with more now about one of the shooting victims, a well-liked staff member at North Shore Congregation Israel.
Jackie Sundheim is described as warm and kind. She was not only a staff member at the Glencoe Congregation, but taught preschool at the Gates of Learning for many years. Jackie is said to have been a lifelong congregant, and the synagogue says in a statement that there are no words to express the sorrow and grief. She is survived by her husband, Bruce, and her daughter, Leah. Dave Berner, 105.9 WBBM.
Spectators at the Highland Park 4th of July parade describe a terrifying and panicked scene when a gunman started shooting. WBBM's Nancy Hardy has reaction.
Bursts of gunfire sent Amirani Garcia and her daughter running. They had been watching the parade near Central and First Street. She says she wasn't sure which way to go since she didn't know where the shooter was.
I just kept running with my daughter. My daughter was just crying. She just, Mommy, I lost my shoe. I lost my shoe. And I'm like, baby, don't worry about your shoe right now. You're going to be fine. I'm going to get you to a safe place.
Alexander Sandoval says he tried to find a place to keep his five-year-old son safe.
I tried to break into one of the buildings, but I couldn't break the glass. The shooting stopped, but like he reloaded, and that's when we had to keep moving, so I picked up my son and I put him in the garbage dumpster.
He says he got separated from his group, and when he went back to look for them, he saw victims lying on the ground. In Highland Park, Nancy Hardy, 105.9 WBBM.
Highland Park's Mayor Nancy Rotering says it was a sad day for her city and the surrounding communities, and it's going to take time to heal.
Our community, like so many before us, is devastated. It's impossible to imagine the pain of this kind of tragedy until you're confronted with it. Gun violence, a mass shooting such as this, casts a much wider net of agony than what the public is typically exposed to. It's a crisis that devastates entire families and communities in a single moment, and we know it's going to take a long, long time, if ever, to heal.
Governor Pritzker says mass shootings have become a weekly tragedy in the United States. He spoke to the media yesterday.
It is devastating that a celebration of America was ripped apart by our uniquely American plague. A day dedicated to freedom has put into stark relief the one freedom we as a nation refuse to uphold, the freedom of our fellow citizens to live without the daily fear of gun violence.
People in Highland Park and surrounding communities are still trying to make sense of yesterday's mass shooting that killed six and injured dozens of others. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin spoke last night expressing anguish and grief over the events that unfolded.
I heard the news about what happened in Highland Park. I was away on a family vacation, about a seven-hour drive, got in the car immediately and started coming toward Highland Park. It took 7 hours and I listened to the story unfold all day. First, the tragedy of what happened at the parade and all the poor victims and those who were killed in the process breaks my heart. The stories are already coming out, and some of them are just things that we'll never forget.
Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul released a statement saying, in part, I'd like to thank the members of law enforcement and the first responders who ran selflessly toward the danger. Raoul's statement also says he remains committed to working with law enforcement partners to prevent the mass tragedies that have devastated too many families.
U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, who was in Highland Park after the shooting, also released a statement. It said, in part, My heart goes out to the families who will never see their loved ones again, and I join the entire Highland Park community in grieving their losses and wishing swift recoveries for the victims who survived. She also says that more must be done to keep communities safe by passing additional common sense gun reforms. An all-day manhunt resulted in the capture of the suspected gunman. Highland Park Chief of Police Lou Jogman says 21-year-old Robert Cremo III stopped his vehicle after leading police officers on a short pursuit.
We are still continuing to process any information that's coming in. We certainly want to make sure that if anybody's got information, video, or anything of that nature, to please. This doesn't necessarily mean it's over, but we're certainly we're encouraged that we have a person of interest.
No charges have been filed at this time.
We're learning more about the person of interest in the killings.
Robert Cremo III was a YouTube rapper. All of those videos and his music on Spotify have been taken down. Some of the video images are violent, including weapons. There are also images of Cremo at local Trump rallies. Friends and family describe him as quiet, keeping to himself, spending a lot of time at his computer. His uncle, Paul Cremo, says he didn't see signs that his nephew would do what he's alleged to have done.
I'm heartbroken. I'm very heartbroken, and I can't even believe it.
His uncle told reporters the suspect was unemployed but had worked at Panera 2 years ago and did not attend college. The father is said to have been the owner of a now-closed deli and unsuccessfully ran for mayor of Highland Park in 2019. Dave Berner, 105.9 WBBM.
WBBM has continued covering the fallout of this case. Later in 2022, more information was revealed about how the shooter obtained his guns.
Our top local story on WBBM, we're taking a closer look at the alleged Highland Park shooter's guns. Some of them were purchased after his father signed a FOID card application. WBBM's Mike Krauser reports.
The Kel-Tec Sub 2000 is a folding carbine that can fit into a backpack. Quick to deploy in situations where time is of the essence, according to the Kel-Tec website. The manufacturer says it picks up where handguns leave off.
The Kel-Tec is what he had in Madison.
Lake County Sheriff's Department Deputy Chief Chris Cavelli, the spokesman for the Major Crimes Task Force, says it was in Madison after the parade shooting where Robert Cremo was seriously contemplating another mass shooting. The weapon used on the rooftop was a Smith & Wesson semi-automatic M&P-15 rifle described as an AR-15-style weapon. Mike Krauser, 105.9 WBBM.
Among those wounded in the Highland Park parade shootings, a North Suburban school superintendent and her twin 8-year-old sons. One of the boys has a severed spinal cord.
8-year-old Cooper Roberts was sedated and put on a ventilator at Comer Children's Hospital, where he has undergone several surgeries. Anthony Luizzi, a family spokesman, says the prognosis for Cooper with the severed spinal cord remains unclear. Luizzi says Cooper's twin brother, Luke, suffered shrapnel wounds to a leg, while his mother, Keeley, suffered foot and leg wounds.
Luke has been treated. He was released from the hospital, and he's recuperating at home with his sisters. Keeley has undergone several surgeries and was discharged from the hospital.
Keeley Roberts is the superintendent of Zion Elementary School District 6. The Roberts family has set up a GoFundMe campaign to raise money to cover medical bills as well as the future costs of Cooper's therapy and rehabilitation.
Lawmakers have also suggested that Cremo's parents take some of the blame for the incident. Other recent cases have seen parents face consequences after mass shootings, including the Ethan Crumbly case in Michigan and the Colt Gray case in Georgia. Here's WBBM with another report on the Cremo case from 2022.
WBBM's Dave Berner with the story.
CBS 2 is reporting that one of the five weapons was illegally picked up at a store called Red Dot Arms in Lake Villa. It's possible it was the high-powered rifle used in the mass shooting. That weapon was reportedly purchased online from another store in another state and then legally shipped to Red Dot. It worked this way because Cremo had a valid firearm owner's identification card. Red Dot's website says the gun store offers weapons training, lists AR-15, AR-10, and AK-47s on its list of available weapons for sale. As of this morning, Red Dot Arms is not commenting on the report. Dave Berner, 105.9 WBBM.
In commenting on this week's mass shooting, Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says the issue of parental responsibility must be dealt with as well.
Senator Dick Durbin is troubled by reports that the alleged Highland Park shooter's father co-signed his firearm owner's ID card so he could purchase the high-powered rifle used in the killings. The suspect reportedly had tried to commit suicide before and threatened to kill his family. Durbin says it makes no sense that his parents would help him buy guns.
That is just an invitation to disaster and to more victims. Parents have a special responsibility when it comes to firearms, and particularly when it comes to assault rifles, for God's sake. And I think there's got to be some culpability and responsibility in this situation.
So-called red flag laws are not enough.
In the years since the tragedy, even more information has been revealed about Cremo and possible warning signs that the massacre was on the horizon.
The man charged in the Highland Park shooting is due in court today. He's facing 7 first-degree murder charges. WBBM's Dave Berner with the latest.
Early in 2020, Robert Cremo III got a state firearm owner's ID card. He needed that to buy the AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle that prosecutors say he used in the shooting. Cremo was too young to get a gun permit in 2019 from the state of Illinois, but police say his father sponsored him for one anyway. Even after there had been an incident where the son had threatened to kill himself and his family. Highland Park has had an ordinance banning semi-automatic rifles since 2013. That weapon and another one found in the car when he was captured were purchased in Chicago. Police say he also had handguns in the home where he lived in Highwood. Dave Berner, 105.9 WBVM.
We're also learning new information about Cremo, who had 2 previous encounters with police.
The first was in April of 2019. Someone called Highland Park Police after learning that Robert Cremo had attempted suicide. Lake County Major Crimes Task Force spokesman Sergeant Chris Cavelli.
This was a delayed report, so Highland Park still responded to the residents a week later, spoke with Cremo, spoke with Cremo's parents, and the matter was being handled by mental health professionals at that time.
The second encounter happened in September of 2019 when one of Cremo's family members contacted police.
A family member reported that Cremo said he was going to kill everyone and Cremo had a collection of knives.
16 knives, a dagger, and a sword were taken from his home and Illinois State Police were notified. Cavelli, though, says there wasn't a probable cause at the time to warrant an arrest. In Highland Park, Rachel Pearson, 105.9 WBBM.
Last year, Cremo pleaded guilty just before his trial was set to begin.
The man accused of murdering 7 people and wounding dozens of others in the Highland Park parade shooting changed his plea this morning to guilty just before his trial was to begin. WBBM's Nancy Hardy joins us from the Lake County Courthouse.
It was a move we expected last summer. Instead, minutes before opening statements by State's Attorney Eric Reinhardt and his team, Robert Cremo III changed his plea to guilty on all 69 counts.
We were prepared for this trial in so many different ways. We have been working for years to present this. We didn't stop working back in June. We all came back to our office and kept working.
Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering says the plea is an important step towards justice, but does not erase pain for those killed, wounded, or still affected by the shooting.
We're all just sort of surprised and relieved that they don't have to experience the unbelievable pain of reliving this experience for the next 3 to 5 weeks.
While survivors did not speak afterwards, they do have a chance to give impact statements at Cremo's sentencing on April 23rd. Outside the Lake County Courthouse, Nancy Hardy, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
Following Cremo's sentencing last year, WBBM's longtime political editor Craig Dallimore, who recently retired, spoke to Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering about the lasting impact of the crime on the community. Here's part of their talk.
The aftermath of the shooting that left 7 people dead and many wounded, Robert Cremo III, the gunman, was sentenced to 7 consecutive life sentences and more time for the others hurt or wounded. And I would think the most important part, Mayor Rotering, was that victims and others impacted got to speak.
Absolutely. The 2 days of the sentencing hearing in Waukegan really were 2 of the most intense days I've ever experienced. And we collectively as a group finally got to hear the full story. Each of us had our moments, our stories, our individual experiences. But then to hear it all literally from the start in 2017 when he started planning this to its conclusion with his sentencing was the turning of a page, I think, for a lot of people. Obviously, for several, The immense loss will never go away of family members who won't be with them to celebrate and to be building new family memories. And for so many people, there were life-changing wounds and injuries. And then for thousands more, there also have been life-changing traumas. So I think for so many of us, it was an important 2 days for us to be together as a community as we continue on this journey forward.
Well, you know, people like to talk about closure when there's tragedy and violence. I don't know if it's possible to get what we traditionally think of as closure on horrors of that magnitude, but what do you get?
You definitely don't get closure, as far as I can tell. And it certainly varies from person to person. People came to that parade with different life experiences and left that parade with different experiences themselves. The closure piece, I think, is more a matter of, we don't want this event to define Highland Park. We don't want to be known as that city that had that shooting on that day at that event. We are an incredible community of caring, supportive people. We saw that in the immediate aftermath, and we've continued to see that now as we approach 3 years hence. And I think it's important, again, we use the word journey intentionally. It's because for so many people, that's what this is. And, you know, as we approach July 4th this year, we're already looking at where do we move from the morning to activity, to action, to community building, to starting our steps forward again as a community. We obviously had the parade for the first time last year. It was absolutely heartbreaking as people were crying on the sidelines because we want that normalcy. We want, especially for our kids, those new memories for them to have that are positive, that they look back fondly. It was interesting. Yesterday, I was talking to John Gray's mom. John is with Blackstone, and his mother still lives in town. And John and Mindy, his wife, generously gave the city $1 million towards a place of remembrance in the immediate aftermath of the shooting. But his mom and John have frequently talked about how, for all of his great achievements, he's always that kid from Highland Park who has great memories of decorating his bike and being in the parade. That's what we want to get back to. I just hosted a group of third graders. We have third graders come through City Hall and we do mock city council meetings, and then we have Ask the Mayor Anything. And a year or two ago, one of the third graders asked me, will we ever get to celebrate the 4th of July? I had to fight tears in that moment. And to me, it's so important that we as a community obviously never forget. And that's why we are carefully building this place of remembrance. But we also want to give our children back that pride, that joy, and that sense of community that everybody carries with them. It's interesting. In the immediate aftermath, I heard from people across this country, famous alums from the high school that we're so proud of, just all coming back and saying, but those are some of my favorite memories, was that parade. So I think we're moving forward slowly but surely, again, with a different lens, but always looking towards this great community and the resilience we saw, not just in the immediate aftermath, but now as we continue forward.
While Highland Park still celebrates with the July 4th parade, Rottering said that that celebration has changed since the mass shooting.
The parade route has changed. The first year, it was really important for us to, in my view, reclaim that route, to say evil and violence doesn't take away this special place in the heart of our community. And so many people, you know, we had 5,000 people walking with us, 5,000 more watched on Zoom. As we crossed through the intersection that's referred to as the hot zone, a lot of people felt a sense of catharsis. However, we also recognize for a lot of people, it still can be difficult to go through that intersection or to be in that plaza, which is, again, right in the heart of our downtown. So we've changed our route. We can now march through a different part of our central business district without giving people that trigger, that momentary feeling of what happened here. The drone question is interesting. The drones during our parade had not been permitted under law. That was a civil liberties action that people felt it would chill speech. But in the aftermath of what happened, we pushed forward for that legislation and asked, is there a way to thread this needle? Is there a way for us to keep people safe from folks who might have evil intentions up on rooftops? It just gives more eyes on a group event that so many people now are edgy, understandably. I mean, these mass shootings are happening hundreds of times a year. People need to have that sense of, if someone's coming for me with evil, we're doing everything we can to mitigate their opportunity. So that law came actually in the aftermath of the shooting. And we will be using those drones again to make sure that people feel safe. It's important for people to recognize we totally support the First Amendment, gathering, free speech, peaceful assembly. There's a lot of that going on these days. We're not doing it to get anybody in trouble. We're doing it to keep people safe. And there are very strict regulations around the use of those drones. So that'll be very helpful.
And you've touched on it already, but I want to ask if how you're approaching what the city does to remember what happened, to remember the victims. But I also know that you've been really looking at different ways of doing things as opposed to just a standard memorial.
Right. And it's important to note, we're using the words place of remembrance intentionally because we are remembering those seven precious lives that have been lost, but we are also remembering the incredibly awful injuries that 48 people suffered. And we're also remembering the trauma that thousands of families endured. And we're also remembering and celebrating the resilience of this community and how we came together to support one another, again, in the immediate aftermath. It's important to note, and this is something that I want to come back to, Craig, we had 1,200 people a day coming for trauma-informed mental health care services. And we had hundreds of professionals in this community who gave free time to help their neighbors work through the immediate trauma. What I want to come back to is that's something that every community needs to have available because these shootings are happening with such regularity. They may be once in a lifetime for some communities. They are a regular occurrence for other communities. And the trauma that comes from living with that kind of violence needs to be addressed, needs to be able to get the help to help those people move forward. And so to me, one of the important lessons that we've all learned as a community hit by a mass shooting is that it looks completely different in some ways for every community, but it looks completely the same for all communities. And what I mean by that is, you know, America's mayors know it's not a matter of if, but when a mass shooting is coming to their community. That's just a reality that people have had to face. But by the same token, we need to recognize the horrible, devastating impact that this kind of violence and trauma can not only have on people's mental health and physical safety, but on their quality of life, on their ability to have a local economy, on their ability to get to school safely, to be able to just live in their home safely. It's so pervasive and so unnecessary. So I think it's important, and you know me, I could go on for days about what we need from Congress, and I will at some point. But for now, it's about that community need and making sure those resources are available. My current state of mind is, if we're not getting rid of the guns, then we need to at least give communities the resources to move forward from these violent traumas that they're experiencing. When a tornado comes through, heaven help those communities impacted last night, but we know this, when tornadoes come through, when a train derails, the government is there immediately to help those communities get back up on their feet. But for whatever reason, they turned a blind eye on the devastating public safety, public health, mental health impacts of these mass violence events. We need to do more to mitigate the causes. But in the meantime, we also need to provide those resources to those communities so they can move forward from these events.
And I do absolutely want to talk about the gun issue. But I also, you know, preface that by pointing out, I think that even if your community hasn't been hit by violence, such violence, You know, when I go to events now, and as I cover them as a reporter, people are looking around. They are watchful. They are nervous.
Right.
They, you know, if you hear yelling, you know, people yelling over there, it might be a bunch of kids having fun, or it might be people who want to know what's going on over there.
Absolutely.
So there's a tension. There's that exists even if it hasn't happened yet.
Absolutely. And my understanding, I think it's the Giffords organization, Gabby Giffords organization, has noted, or maybe it was Pew, somebody did a survey and found that 2/3 of Americans have changed their behavior around concerns of possible gun violence impacting them, whether it's avoiding events, looking for second exits at the movie theater, you know, being hypervigilant in certain circumstances. And it's unnecessary. Again, it's unnecessary. We know that our peer nations don't live this way. And when they come here, or, you know, I teach at Northwestern, I have students from other countries, and they've said to me, people have asked them, why would you go to the United States for school when it's such a violent place? And we've become, I fear, kind of inured to some extent, and we shouldn't be. This should not be acceptable. There's an interesting quote somebody wrote after July 4th, 2022, and she said, it's not just the impact and loss of life, but it's the impact on quality of life. And it really is true. So I agree with you. We're always kind of looking, where's that second exit?
And I think people may forget that even before the 2022 tragedy, Highland Park was focused, under your leadership, focused on the issue of guns. It was one of 16 communities in Illinois to restrict firearms and passed an assault weapons ban following another mass shooting at Sandy Hook. So as a community, you saw this coming, and still, I mean, but that shows how pervasive it is.
Absolutely. And so, you know, in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, interestingly, the state of Illinois gave us that opportunity. It was a 10-day window in the concealed carry law that allowed home rule municipalities to ban assault weapons. You had to take action within 10 days of that law being enacted, sort of a clear reflection of the sausage making of legislation in Springfield. But current Lake County Commissioner, then City Council member Paul Frank, highlighted this for us. And we said, this absolutely reflects our values. How could you, 6 months post Sandy Hook, as a parent, as a human being, not feel like if there's an opportunity to do something to mitigate assault weapon violence, you had to take that opportunity? So we talked for about 30 seconds. Somebody said, what if we get sued by the NRA? And we all said, we still need to do this. And they argued back, but we're a small city. We don't have the money. And we said, but we still need to do this. You have to take those opportunities. We weren't being blithe. We weren't being, you know, dismissive. We just felt so strongly that we needed to take that action. And as you know, we did get sued through the Illinois arm of the NRA. And we went all the way to essentially the Supreme Court. The Seventh Circuit allowed our law to prevail. The Supreme Court decided not to hear the case, but that essentially said in the Seventh Circuit, this law is deemed constitutional. And we immediately went to work and started to contact the Illinois General Assembly and said, can you change the law? The Seventh Circuit has now said it's okay to ban assault weapons. We need to allow other communities to have this opportunity. Nobody responded. At some point, Kwame Raoul, who was then senator and chair of the Judiciary Committee for the Senate, invited me to come speak to that committee. I don't think it got out of committee, but it never made it to the floor. When I said in 2018, I believe it was, you can take away this limit, this state preemption. You can allow other communities to ban assault weapons, or better yet, why not ban them as a state? And again, that kind of went nowhere. Fast forward, heaven help us, to May of 2022, and the Uvalde shooting happened. And I called my senator, and we decided I would write a letter to then Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Senate President Don Harmon and the Speaker of the House, Chris Welch. And I said to them, we've been talking about this now for almost 10 years. Can the state consider a ban on assault weapons, or can we at least give other communities this right to ban assault weapons? And I didn't hear anything. And then 6 weeks later, the shooting happened in Highland Park. And I had a copy of that letter on my phone. And when the governor came to bring his condolences and to show his support for our community, I said, while you're here, I need to show you something that I sent you 6 weeks ago. Will you consider this ban, this statewide ban on assault weapons? And thankfully, our state rep, Bob Morgan, and our state senator, Julie Morrison, were able to move that legislation forward. And the state of Illinois in 2023 passed a statewide assault weapons ban. So far, they've been able to withstand all of the judicial challenges that people have tried to throw at them. But we're not an island, and we're surrounded by states that have ridiculously lax gun laws. And so we know that the vast majority of guns used primarily in Chicago shootings with regularity are coming from Indiana, Mississippi, Missouri. It's incumbent upon this country to pass, again, a federal assault weapons ban. There was one in 1994. It ran until 2004. During that time, according again to the Giffords Organization, mass shooting related deaths dropped by 70%. And there's a call for this. The vast majority of Americans support banning these weapons because they know that weapons designed to kill as many people as fast as possible have no place in the hands of civilians. So that's where I think we need to be headed. Obviously, we have this balance with the Second Amendment. But let's be honest, folks. If you can't hit the deer that you're hunting with a regular sports gun, then maybe you should take up fishing. I believe that's what Senator Durbin has said with regularity. But, you know, our peer nations don't allow people to have these guns without very clear psychological background checks, very clear training, very strict requirements on when these guns can be used. And I think we as a nation deserve better. I think our kids deserve better. It's a matter of public safety and public health and quality of life.
WBBM's Renita Young reported on the continued impact of this shooting just this week.
During that mass shooting 4 years ago, a gunman opened fire into a crowd in Highland Park during its annual 4th of July parade, killing 7 people and injuring 48 others. And local nonprofit HP3 One Step Away now wants to take aim at a group they feel bears some of the responsibility. The PSA says, like on that day, the difference between life and death often comes down to where you stand, and wants to urge Americans to use their purchasing power to reduce gun violence. Renita Young, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
As the mayor of Highland Park noted, the tragedy in her town is just one of many mass shootings reported in the U.S. Ahead of America celebrating its 250th anniversary this weekend, ABC's Rich Frankel, a former FBI special agent in charge, and a former member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, joined Odyssey station KCBS Radio in the Bay Area to discuss how violent crimes have reshaped the way that we celebrate.
Rich, good morning. What are the main security concerns as we head into this July 4th weekend?
Well, you know, it's 250. It's, you know, big celebrations throughout the country. And we've got a lot of events going on, everything from OpSale 2026 on the East Coast to the president in South Dakota, to the World Cups taking place throughout the country. And then just for fun, we're going to have probably a backyard barbecue or big event in every city in every state of the country. So lots of stuff going on. So law enforcement is out there in force, ready for anything. But there are no active threats right now. It's just that all law enforcement is preparing for that inevitable thing that could happen at any of these locations.
Yeah, we always hear that there are no credible threats, which is reassuring. What worries you more, Rich, as someone who was on the Joint Terrorism Task Force and has dealt with this stuff? Is it more an organized threat from an enemy state or the lone wolf attackers?
Yes. Now, the lone wolf attackers are harder for us to identify prior to their starting. While they can be deadly and they can be very dangerous, they are their impact at times could be lower because it's just one person. You know, the issue, though, is what does that one person have? Does he have explosives? Does he have a weapon? Does he have an automatic weapon? You know, how much does he know? Has he prepared for this? Those are all things that we worry about with the lone wolf. With a terror group, you know, we're worried about, you know, the organizational effect of the group. What can they do? That could they hit more than one location? Could this be a larger attack when they do go to those locations? And then the nation state, that is, you know, are they planning a cyber attack? You know, many have tried with cyber attacks against the U.S., especially on like a July 4th weekend where they can go after the power grid. Or are they going to try something more tactical? And when I'm worrying about these, I'm not saying any of these are actually going to happen, but this is what law enforcement is looking at. They've broken these up. They're looking at all of them, and they're looking at them from those angles. They've got covert assets out there protecting people. They've got technical resources out there protecting people. They've got protective layers at events so that when you go there, they're determining if somebody's trying to get in there with, you know, a device or a weapon that could cause harm. So, again, all of these are being looked at, and I don't have one that keeps me up at night more than the others. I think altogether, there's just that overarching threat that, you know, when I was there, we were always prepared for, and I believe who's ever out there in the FBI, DHS, local law enforcement, that's what they're out there preparing for.
Rich, when we think back to 9/11 25 years ago, and now we fast forward 25 years, terror threats have really evolved with the times. There was no, you know, cyber crime to speak of back then. We didn't have drones back then. There are so many things now that the feds and local police have to be on the lookout for that just didn't exist back in the days of 9/11.
Correct. Yeah. You know, a drone was, you know, one of those old planes, you know, that you go to a special field and they would take off there. Now a drone can go from anywhere, you know, literally can, you know, you can hold it in your hand as you walk out your house and have a drone go up. The threat has definitely evolved. The good thing is the technology to identify these threats has also evolved as terrorists or bad guys make up new ways to, you know, potentially harm people. Law enforcement has been out there coming up with ways to detect it and deter it. There are ways to, you know, and we've seen this at the World Cup, you know, drones, even though they've been banned, I think there are over 50 drones that have been identified in the area of the World Cup in New Jersey. Those have been taken down. Those people who sent them up have either been charged with something or, you know, gotten, you know, violations. They're being handled. But you're 100% right that the threat has grown and the ability for bad guys to do bad things has grown.
Thank you all so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WBBM News Radio in Chicago, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, KNX News in Los Angeles, the Mark Cox Morning Show out of 97.1 The Talk in St. Louis, and KCBS Radio in San Francisco. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.